Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Priddy v. Healthcare Service Corporation. Mr. Joshi.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Sopan Joshi, and I represent the defendant in this case, Healthcare Service Corporation. As you know, this is an interlocutory appeal of a class certification order, a certification order that the plaintiffs in their brief in this court have barely attempted to defend, and for good reason. The class certification order really is indefensible. The district court certified four classes comprising some 10 million people across five states to pursue five different claims under ERISA and Illinois common law. These classes fail to meet the basic requirements of Rule 23.
So, Mr. Joshi, could you just review for me how many of these points you were able to raise before the district court?
Well, we filed a motion in opposition to their class certification motion.
Sure, and I understand a general motion to oppose, but did you delve into the detail that you have here?
I'm sure we've refined our points a little bit on appeal, but as we pointed out in our brief, and as you can see from the record, their class certification motion was very bare bones, very conclusory. Their memorandum of law in support of the motion was two pages long in substance. I went through and counted it again. You can see appendix page 238. You know, there are only three sentences of actual, like, analysis supporting it, and it was all based on the Tyson case. And so at that point in the district court, you know, it was fairly early in the proceedings, and you know, our only job was to say they haven't met their burden. And we did that, and we did offer more detail, including some of the stuff we have in our brief now.
Mm-hmm. So when you were talking about not meeting their burden, this is obviously a very important point in this case, because the burden is on the party who wants the class, normally it's a plaintiff class, of course, to meet the criteria of Rule 23. And you've now gone through in great detail and explained to us why you don't think they met their burden on these various, everything, by numerosity, I take it you're conceding, since there are 10 million people. I think you're using that point differently. That was actually one of my concerns about this case, just to make sure that they got the proper shot at the district court they needed.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they did. I mean, you know, it's the plaintiff's burden. It was their motion, and their motion was woefully, we think, inadequate. And, you know, we pointed that out to the district court. And really, if one of the things about class certification is it's not just about the people in the courtroom. It's about the absent class members. And because of that, it is really incumbent on plaintiffs and plaintiffs' counsel and the district court to engage in the rigorous analysis that Rule 23 demands, that this court and the Supreme Court have said district courts must engage in. And it is really to protect the rights of all the people who aren't in the courtroom.
Which is why we often have this bizarre situation, which we do in this case, of the defendant zealously attempting to represent the interests of the unnamed members of the class, whereas the plaintiffs are saying, no, everything's fine. This case had been pending for quite some time, right, before the class certification motion was filed?
It had been. I believe most of that delay was in between when the motion to dismiss had been fully briefed, which was back in March of 2015, I believe, and the decision on the motion to dismiss, which didn't come till the very end of March 2016. So there was over a year delay, between that. And I think that was mostly the delay. After that, they filed their class certification motion very shortly after that. We filed our response in April. I think they filed a reply, which technically isn't allowed.
And was discovery going on? How much discovery was going on?
Discovery was going on, but once this court granted the 23F petition, the plaintiffs moved to stay discovery during the pendency of this appeal, and we agreed to that. So it stayed right now.
Okay.
As I was saying, the district court really didn't engage in the rigorous analysis, and I think that's what really led it astray, because even a cursory analysis would have revealed that it does not meet the Rule 23 requirements. And so I'll briefly touch on those requirements and explain why the classes don't meet those requirements, but I want to preface that discussion, as I said, with that overarching point, which is, you know, the lack of analysis is really what infects the entire certification order.
So could I just clarify, because actually sometimes when people come before us and they're complaining about a lack of analysis, the remedy is to send it back to the district court judge and tell the judge to do a better job with the analysis, but I don't take it that that's the relief you want.
If that's all we can get, we'll take it. But yes, you're right. What we want is, you know, we firmly believe that these classes are just not certifiable, period. And that's because, as you know, class certification requires you to look at the merits of the claims, and the claims that they've brought are ones that are simply not amenable to class-wide resolution on a class-wide basis with common class-wide proof. So, for example, if we go to commonality, you know, as Walmart, this court in Jamie S. has said, you know, it's not just about raising questions, it's about common answers that can drive the resolution of the litigation.
Now, that was the phrase that the late and wonderful Professor Richard Nagarita used, which was cited by the Supreme Court in the Walmart case. Does the record contain anything other than that one version of the policy that, I suppose I should call it HCSC, but kind of Blue Cross Blue Shield? It's my out-of-the-record recollection that there are actually quite a few different policies, but maybe it's not in the record.
So what's in the record before the court is the sample policy that they attached to their complaint, and then we attached, I think, Priddy's policy to our motion to dismiss. And I believe those are the only two that are in the record right now, although obviously we've been able to find the policies of each of the named plaintiffs at least.
So you argue quite a bit that there are, in fact, many types of policies, and that's one of your reasons for saying commonality is lacking.
There are, so...
But how do we know that? Are you just saying you're saying so, or how do we know that?
So essentially, I think our point on that is twofold. First of all, and most important, the district judge dismissed all the policy-based claims already, so they're not in the case. So it actually doesn't really matter the differences among the policies. But the second point to that is you know, again, it's the plaintiff's burden to show commonality. And so, you know, if they were in the counterfactual world still bringing a policy-based claim, they would have to assert and show that, in fact, all the policies in the class are identical. And they haven't done that. And so for both of those reasons, you know, we think it doesn't really, you know, they haven't met their proof there. You know, their real claim is a fiduciary claim under both ERISA and Illinois common law. And it's about, you know, the misuse of insurance premiums that we collect. And yet, as we point out in the brief, three of the four classes include both people who paid premiums to us and people who didn't pay premiums to us, and beneficiaries of both of those kinds of people who also don't pay premiums to us. And that alone renders the classes too diverse for certification. One of the classes, the fourth one, as written, it includes every single person in Illinois who has health insurance. Now, you know, that maybe that was just a little sloppy, and we can sort of understand that maybe what they meant was those who are somehow customers of us, and that's fine.
That's with regard to the so-called receivership claim, and you know, a receivership is not an independent claim. It's just a remedial device, and so I'm having difficulty with the theory of the case, quite frankly. To the extent that we have ERISA and common law claims left after the motion to dismiss was decided, they are fiduciary breach claims for sort of vague and amorphous misuse of premiums paid. And it's not clear to me what theory of fiduciary breach that allegation rests on, what the law is. I don't know what the elements of that claim would be. They haven't been articulated either by the plaintiffs or the district court. And those are sort of baselines that need to be touched in order to understand a class certification request, and I just don't see that here. Do you have any idea of what the theory of the case is?
I have to be honest, Your Honor, we really don't, and you know, I couldn't agree with you more. They haven't articulated the theory. As best we can tell, you know, it's what we've got, is that we somehow misuse insurance premiums, but of course, premiums aren't ERISA plan assets, and so there can't be a breach there. And under Illinois law, of course, an insured is not the fiduciary of an insured. And so I don't see the claims there either. And so our point here is really that almost, you know, because there really is no claims here, there's no articulation of what the elements of the claims are, then you know, we think there shouldn't be a case to begin with, but then a fortiori, it means that the class members, the absent class members, don't have a claim either. And that's the that's another ground on which to reverse the class certification order. And you know,
but you would agree, I take it, that the only thing that's properly before us right now is the propriety of the class certification order. The district court, should you prevail here, will wrap up whatever the district court wraps up.
That is correct, but as I understand this court's practice and you know practice in general, it's this court can opine on, of course, on the merits of the claims. You know, I'll point this court to the recent Allergan case in which the court really dismissed that class action. You know, looking hard at the merits. You know, this court has there was a case many years ago, the West versus Prudential Securities case, where it was a class action. The court dismissed, it was a class action brought under Basic versus Levinson fraud on the market, but the defendant had actually just given private advice to only his clients, and the court said, well, that's not, Basic doesn't extend that far to, you know, to private advice, it's only for public information, and so dismissed the class. I would have to assume when it went back down, the district judge either looked at summary judgment or sure. Reconsidered. I'd like to reserve my time.
Certainly, you may. Yes, Ms. St. Saul.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Alexandra de St. Saul, and I represent all the plaintiffs in this case. I want to touch briefly on the standard of review. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. That's the most deferential standard of review.
Well, it is, except that we do have 23F, which permits us to review class certifications. And I have to say, just trying to correlate these various theories with the four classes is a real task. The Supreme Court has made it quite clear that not only do classes need to be defined with some precision, but we need to see, you know, what are the elements of the claims? Are they amenable to class-wide proof or not? Your brief was disturbing to me in that it seemed to misunderstand the notion that until a class is certified, anything a judge does is exclusively with respect to the individuals before it.
Your Honor, I agree with you. I think you are correct.
But your brief didn't seem to operate on that assumption, which was at least unhelpful for me.
I understand. I understand that. I think as there was an issue raised in the brief about the motion to dismiss and that the defendant didn't take the issue, didn't raise the issue of the different states. And granted, that's that a defendant admits facts in a motion to dismiss where it doesn't on opposing class certification.
But there was nothing in the district court's rulings dismissing various parts of this case that spoke at all to whether there was a class. And I'm mystified that with the time that existed, you didn't engage in discovery related to the class certification, that you didn't, for example, try to see if the policies all had the language to which you object. You didn't try to distinguish between Blue Cross Blue Shield as the actual insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield as the administrator. You didn't try to distinguish between situations where the employer was offering a benefit plan that would be ERISA kinds of plans, ERISA benefit plans, and situations in which there was just an A to B market transaction between a person who wanted insurance and Blue Cross. So it was your responsibility to gather all of this information.
Yes, Your Honor, it is true. And we initially have the burden of proof, but an appellant on appeal also has obligations.
But how did you satisfy your burden to show, I mean, I'm thinking of not just Walmart, but Comcast, Italian Colors. I mean, there's so many Supreme Court decisions at this point that are saying this is a major step in the litigation. You can't just rest on your pleadings.
That is true. But, I mean, if you look at this court's decisions, like, for example, in Sabo, in the Messner decision. Basically, what this court said in Szabo is that a judge must make factual and legal inquiries that are necessary under Rule 23. Well, we don't know what those factual inquiries unless the defendant at least makes an issue of them.
No, you do know. You know that you have four parts of 23A that you have to satisfy.
Right.
And they're predictably challenging everything except the numbers. And you, and because this is a B3 class, you have to show predominance and superiority. You know that. So you need to make an initial showing other than just we say so.
Well, we alleged that the policies had similar language for all class members.
You don't have any claims left that relate to the policies.
Pardon?
You have no claims left that relate to the insurance policies. All that's left are the fiduciary breach claims.
That is true. They are fiduciary claims under the policies, but obviously the policies give rise to a fiduciary duty because otherwise there would be no relationship.
With respect to benefits decisions, not anything else. Which
right.
which is a basic flaw in the theory of the case.
Well,
seems to me it should have been dismissed, but
the Supreme Court decided back in the case of Deposit Guarantee versus Roper that a defendant may not attempt interlocutory review of rulings on motions to dismiss.
That was long before Rule 23F existed. I mean, the problem, I remember Roper very well, but the problem the court was addressing is one that has been completely solved by the addition of Rule 23F to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Well, that's true, but there still is the issue that, I mean, the major issues are indeed the class certification issues, and the class certification issues that have been raised on this appeal basically concern, number one, commonality and typicality.
And you didn't put, it was your job to put evidence in the record, and I'm not going to tell you what kind of evidence may have been out there, whether it was from depositions, whether it was from policy language, whether it was from documents. Evidence could be a lot of things, but there's no evidence in this record that any of those criteria are met.
Your Honor, Messner and it states that we have the obligation to put in evidence if there are disputes.
But no, that's where you're wrong. You are the one who wants a class action. So, in a word, you have the burden of proof on that. And so you can't just say, we want class action, and shift the burden of proof to the defendants to point out the kinds of defenses they're going to raise. You've got to make, to use the phrase, you know, kind of a prima facie showing that you meet these criteria. And that's, and you can't just rely on your complaint to do that.
But as far as, I mean, with the answer to the complaint, the defendant did not raise any objection as far as our allegations. They admitted that the language which we said in the complaint that relates to all class, to both Illinois and we had representatives from Oklahoma and Texas, that language was similar. They admitted that in their complaint, in the answer to their complaint. That is evidence. That's an admission. And the court says to determine whether or not common questions predominate, the court must only look so far as to determine whether there's common evidence.
That statement, and actually the citation in the court's opinion that follows that comment, I want to find it because it's old law. It really doesn't take into account what the Supreme Court has been saying about class actions. in more recent years.
Well, I know
common issues predominate. I mean, it just sort of says so.
I mean, but I mean, Messner was decided by this court in 2012.
Okay, you've exhausted that line of argument, counsel. This is not a Messner case. All right. If you could articulate as straightforwardly as possible the elements of the remaining claims in this case, both under ERISA and the common law.
Under ERISA, the...
First, what claims remain?
The claims remain with regard to ERISA that the defendant misused its premiums to arrogate to itself profits from its affiliates, which in administering those, I mean...
And what kind of legal violation is that?
That's a violation of the fiduciary responsibilities of a person who is managing a plan and plan assets.
The insurance company here was not managing plan assets. The insurance company was providing insurance and administering benefits claims. It's not a plan administrator.
But the district court determined.
There were no determinations. There was a motion to dismiss. District
right.
courts don't make determinations on motions to dismiss.
I understand that.
And I'm asking you to articulate your theory of fiduciary breach under ERISA and under the common law.
Under the common
law. By reference to legal elements of the claim, both statutory and common law.
Under the common law, under the case.
Start with ERISA. That's okay. Why the case is in federal court.
Okay. Under ERISA, the plan.
What elements do you need to prove to establish a fiduciary relationship vis-a-vis the actions that are alleged to be illegal in this case?
We have to show, i.e., that there was a relationship between the policyholders in the beneficiaries are derivative only, but the policyholders entered into a through their employers, most of them, through their employers, a contractual relationship out of which a fiduciary duty rose. Healthcare service company is a mutual company. It is owned by its policyholders. Ergo, a duty arises for it not to arrogate to itself its premiums. And in fact, the policy language specifically said...
What actions are alleged to have violated the fiduciary duty that you allege existed?
They're purchasing and taking profits of their affiliates unto themselves and declaring in their policies that they could not be shared.
How is that a violation of ERISA?
Because of the fact that ERISA sets out a fiduciary duty that is required. And so that is what is there.
And what are the common legal and factual issues
The common and legal factual issues are Healthcare Service Corporation operated as a sole decision maker, unlike Walmart case where you had millions of different separate employment decisions made by millions of different supervisors. That's different. Or the James versus Milwaukee case. Every individual child was different because of the fact that they had individual education plans. That's not here. You have a common decision maker making common decisions with regard to allocations of its assets. In its answer to the complaint, they acknowledge that they used these premiums in part to buy these affiliates and to keep those affiliates separate. They acknowledge that in their answer to the complaint. So we had no idea that there even was an issue. They never raised an issue of the fact that there might be differences between Illinois plaintiffs and Illinois plaintiffs and Texas and Oklahoma plaintiffs. Wasn't raised. With regard to the issue of whether there are conflicts between class members, it wasn't raised. We do have the burden of proof, but we shouldn't be set, and the district court shouldn't have to peruse issues which it doesn't even knows exists. And so that's why there is indeed commonality, because there's a unitary decision maker. The decisions were made uniform across all class members. And so simply by this court's own cases of Spano and also the very recent case of the McMullen case, all decided that there was where there's a common question, and i.e. here there is a common question. Did the defendant act appropriately or not? And that's common. And that the beneficiaries, their interests derive solely from the policy owners. And with regard to the administrative claims, yes, their damages are indirect, but okay. The duty still arises out of the unitary policy.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Joshi? Can I just ask you one question? It's always interesting to me in class actions. If this had been a settlement class, I imagine that HCHS would have been delighted to have it be a class, because you would have had claim preclusion against 10 million people instead of against 2 or 6 or whatever the number is.
Perhaps
if you're very clear on your position on the merits.
Perhaps, Your Honor, although in practice, and I think this case demonstrates that, litigation is not perfect. Sometimes judges make errors, sometimes litigants make errors, and so I think we might, you know, worry about that. We might think we're buying our piece, but then it turns out that we're actually open to a collateral challenge precisely because of, for example, the adequacy issues that we raised in our brief.
But of course, if you win here and there's no class, but there's also no merits decision, all these other people out there could still sue you.
That's true. I think we'd still rather not have the sort of course of effect of a 10 million person class asking to put us in a receivership hanging over us.
Understood.
The only point I wanted to make was, my friend noted that, you know, in our answer we acknowledged we use premiums to buy affiliates. Yes, we do use premiums, and yes, we do own, you know, a piece of Prime Therapeutics, which was, you know, a pharmacy benefit manager. But that's not a common fact that drives the litigation forward. There's nothing untoward about a company buying an affiliate. And moreover, insurance premiums, as we've said repeatedly, are not plan assets. And in fact, in that answer, which is paragraph 62 of the complaint that we answered, and that's docket 27. It's not in the appendix, but it is in the record. We said specifically in the answer to paragraph 62, yes, we have insurance premiums. That's part of our revenue. But we do not manage any plan assets of any plans whatsoever. That's where the litigation stands. Unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask you to reverse.
Apparently not. So thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.